stay with the house. So, so if you want to do it.
Oh, we have to.
You heard him. It won't be boring.
Right away, we show up.
That's way.
No, just don't say that.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, what's the number of the bill, please?
444.
Okay.
Nobody, including the witnesses, understood it, so here we are again.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to state that I have been attempting to intimidate the witness. 444, is that a Senate bill?
You have a couple of things in there too, Art. Besides.
I don't have it.
Thomas gave us last year, I think, all of that. You don't. Okay, well, I'll make sure you have these. Mike, you want to go ahead and start off this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Thomas, and I'm here representing the American Life Insurance Association. As I was last year when we talked about this bill, as the chairman says, we didn't manage to all learn enough last year. So we are trying again. To my left is Daphne Bartlett, who is a vice president of Occidental Life Insurance Association. Excuse me. I'm going to make everything into an association by the time I'm through. She understands it much better than I do, or probably most anybody else we're likely to meet. She would like to make a presentation to you about House Bill 444. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much time do I have?
Well, you have till 3 o'clock.
No. It's really nice to be here. Thank you for listening to me. I thought maybe I'd tell you a little bit about myself, because you've probably never seen a lady actuary before. And an actuary is, as you might know, a mathematician who specializes in the life insurance industry and the mathematics of mortality and stuff like that. Actuaries are in a rather difficult situation, because most of them work for companies. And so they kind of wear two hats, which perhaps some of you do too. Sometimes we wear our company hat, and sometimes we have to wear what we consider and are very proud of, which is a professional hat. And my company paid for my plane ticket up here, but I wouldn't be here unless I really believed in this, as when I wear my professional hat. The law, first of all, I should explain why the company is paying for my ticket. We are specifically interested in passage of this bill because we have prepared a new rate book which incorporates in a few of the plans that we plan to be selling starting in March 1st in most of the United States, this 4% interest. And we will not be able to introduce this particular rate book in Alaska. Another reason that I'm here is because I feel quite strongly that uniform regulation between the states is very important. And it costs a lot of money for companies doing business in multiple states to adopt to multiple regulations. And in effect, that is what Occidental will have to do. I believe that there is some opposition to this bill in Alaska. And I've tried very hard to figure out why, and I can't. It's a very simple change. I can honestly assure you that I think it's a safe change. And I hope you will listen to me and do whatever it is that you do accordingly. Let me try and explain, if I could, this bill that we are trying to, this law that we're trying to amend. Would it be okay if I handed out some charts?
Sure.
I did plan to do some nice, big, you know, artistic things to hand out, but I got very busy, and so I just drew them up myself, and
Just passing around.
Make some copies.
We start on the side.
You have all the people?
Well, we have a presentation.
I may not follow this text. I'd like, please, if it's appropriate and according to oil, if you want to interrupt any time and ask questions, perfectly okay.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned something a little earlier about 4% package, and I assume you probably meant to expand upon that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're fine. I'm fresh for it right now. I didn't understand
okay.
What you meant. So.
Okay. This piece of legislation, incidentally, is one of the few changes that the life insurance industry is united upon. As I'm sure you know, there are many, many companies in the United States, and we don't always agree. Occidental happens to be, perhaps have the reputation of being kind of a wild or radical company. We're creative, we do novel things. There very frequently are strong disagreements as to policy between the mutual companies and the stock companies, between large companies and small companies and so on. And this is a piece of legislation that everybody agrees on. They all think it's fine. Okay, let me try now and describe these two laws that, and I'm sure Mike, do you have the numbers of the ones that we're trying to change by this bill?
Well,
anyway.
They're set out in the bill as the sections go along.
Okay.
Would you like to have a copy of the bill?
Yes, thank you.
You got one there.
The purpose, okay, thank you. Maybe I can refer to it. There are two things we are trying to change. One is the minimum reserve standards, and the other is the non-forfeiture benefit standards. I'll try and explain what these laws say. Dick Block and I had a conversation before lunch where we both agreed that it would be marvelous if we could rewrite this law and make it understandable. I'm not suggesting that. Please don't do that right now, but I would be very happy to volunteer my services privately to get this thing written clearer, because it is a hairy thing to understand. Anyway, the minimum reserve standards. First of all, what's a minimum reserve? Probably all of you know that as you get older, your chances of dying are greater. Probably you also know that the most popular form of life insurance is the one that's called level premium life insurance, where you pay the same amount every year. Because you have to, under a policy such as this, you pay the same amount every year. That means that when you're very young, you pay too much for the insurance. Your chance of dying at, let's say, age 25 is peanuts. But your chance of dying when you're 70 is very substantial. And so in order to pay a level premium, you have to pay more in the beginning, and subsequently you pay less later when you're very old. Therefore, the company has to take some of that money that they receive from the policyholder early on and save it for them, so that when their chance of dying later becomes greater, they add that to the premium they're receiving, and so that in total they have enough to pay the death claim. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
Good. Okay. What the minimum valuation law says is a company has to hold, for each different kind of policy, a minimum amount of money at each point in time throughout the life of the policy. If you look at chart one, and these are not real numbers, I just drew this at home the other night. if you buy a whole life policy, what happens is that the company has to have on hand $1,000 by the time you reach the end of the mortality table, which is age 100, if you don't die in between. And so reserves start at a low level and they just grow up. And at the end of the mortality table, the company pays off on your life insurance. You don't have to die to collect, in case any of you are injured. So what this law says right now is these reserves that the company has to hold, you can hold more if you like, but you have to hold at least a certain amount, and it depends on all kinds of actuarial principles. You have to hold enough based on this mathematical calculation involving a 3.5% interest assumption. I can go into the actuarial math of it, but I think it would bore you. Any questions? Right now.
Now you're saying the 3.5% is that's just the
interest.
The interest.
There is a standard mortality table that also has to be used. That is a very conservative mortality table. And it's intended to, remember, that this law is intended to apply to all kinds of companies, some of whom will sell to people who are, they may issue it what they call standard rates to a wider range of people than others. There are conservative companies in terms of issuing insurance, and there are liberal companies. And these standards have to apply to companies of all different kinds. The standard mortality table is supposed to cover all these ranges, all possible companies. Okay. All that the companies are asking with respect to this minimum reserve standard is a change in the interest from the 3.5% to the 4%, which results in lowering the reserves that will be held at any point in time. It's like if you want to have $1,000 in the bank a year from now, and the bank's paying 5% interest, you have to put in less money today than if the bank were paying 4% interest. Okay? So the higher the interest rate, the lower the reserves. Okay, now, most companies, I would suspect, will not use this 4% valuation standard for life insurance. The mutual companies in New York, most of them, the large mutuals, because they're participating, they have generally very conservative premium rates, and they usually have very high cash values, which are based on a 2.5% interest. So I suspect that only a few companies will be using the 4. All this does is permit its use if necessary. Okay, now non-forfeiture values, that's the other piece that we're asking for change. Remember before I said, okay, on level premium, you pay too much in the beginning and too little later to cover the increase in mortality. Let's say after a couple of years you've bought this life insurance policy and you decide to quit. What the law currently says is the company has to return to the policyholder at least a certain amount. That's what minimum non-forfeiture benefits are. Is the minimum that any particular type of policy has to return on termination. It's called a cash value as a rule, the minimum you have to do. So if I at Occidental am developing a policy and I say, gee, I don't want to pay any cash values on this thing, I can't develop a policy like that because it would be a violation of the law as it now exists. However, if I say I want to pay some cash values that are higher than the minimums provided by this law. I may. Any company can do that. All that this is saying is the companies have got to give back at least this much in any contract they design. Okay, now, if you buy a life insurance policy, however, the cash values are set out in that policy, and they could very conceivably be higher than the minimums provided here, and the company has to pay you the amount that's in your policy. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, but there is a minimum standard.
Yeah, you have to pay at least
every policy.
That's right.
And having not really read the bill here this year, are you proposing a change in that, or I suppose a lower cash value requirement?
Minimum requirement, yes.
A lower?
Yes, it's exactly like this graph here on chart one, that the higher the interest rate, again, would be the lower the cash value, okay? Now, there are some benefits associated with that, which is that, as you probably know, life insurance policies have a fairly high lapse rate in the first and second policy years. I'm not here to address that question, but it is a fact, an unfortunate fact. Because of the sales costs involved in setting up a life insurance policy, and that it also obviously involves agent's commission, but it also involves underwriting expense, which is where you give a policyholder a medical exam, see if he's healthy and insurable, and the expense of issuing the policy and stuff like that. All that money is wasted, in effect, if the policyholder then immediately quits. So the company suffered very great loss on early termination. Now, if the minimum cash values, or if the cash values that are allowed to be payable on early termination are lower than currently, the companies will suffer less financial loss on early termination, and thus can afford to charge a lower premium for those people who do not terminate early on.
They can afford to, but...
And they would. I have. If you just flip to the end, maybe I can give you an illustration of that. Chart 7 shows what this happens to be. The 4% columns happen to be the actual cash values that Occidental will be allowing on a new policy that will be coming out on its new rate, the 4% numbers, okay? What I did when I knew I was coming here was go to some of the staff, and I said, would you do exactly the same using the 3.5%? And say, what would the cash values be, and what would the premium be, keeping the profit the same, so that if we had developed this policy on the same profit objectives, the 3.5% cash values, what premium would have evolved? And the premiums, you'll notice here, the cash values are slightly lower on the 4% than they would have been on the 3.5. But the premium, if you look on the next page at chart 8, was quite significantly lower. Now what this does is offer, I feel, the insurance buying public a choice. Not all of the plans that Occidental is going to be selling are based on 4%, because there is a market for plans that are based on 2.5%. We have some plans like that in our portfolio too, and we'll always continue to do so. But what we are offering here, I think, is a product where if somebody wants a very low cash outlay, is not planning to quit, is buying this thing for insurance only, he's getting it for a lower outlay, less money out of his pocket.
That's only if he's 25.
No.
Oh, those are things that are okay. It gets less as you get older, the same.
Yeah, and the reason for that is because this is a plan, it happened to be one that we are selling on 4%. It's a life paid up at 65, okay? So that at age 45, this guy only has 20 premiums to pay. At the end of 20 years, at 65, he stops paying premiums. Okay, so the wording in this law is, as I say, a mess. What it's trying to do in its present form is to say the companies have to save enough money, set enough money aside to provide for that future mortality that's going to occur on these people who are paying level premium policies. The non-forfeiture law is saying in any policy you design, you have to have at least these minimum cash values returned if the guy quits. And these are defined by standard mortality table, standard interest rate. And we're saying these standards are now too conservative. They are causing a burden to the carriers because, as I think we all know, interest rates are not 3.5%. Unfortunately, they are, new money interest rates are around 8%. Yes?
Is that 3.5% or where it got to be a 4%? Is that set deliberately low to allow for the money that the insurance company to lose the stock market on the year or something?
No.
You said 8%. Sure, but a lot of that was money. These number of the big companies did lose a lot of money in the stock market,
including Occidental.
So, is that the difference between 8% and 4, or 8 and 3.5 is to allow for that?
Not at all. No, I'm not an investment expert, and I don't pretend to be.
Just give me a layman's term.
Yeah. Okay. The important thing. Although insurance companies do lose money in the stock market, a very small percentage of their assets are invested in the stock market. I'm not sure, Dick, do you know, is there a law here on that? I know that in most states, there's, I think, a maximum of 5% of their assets can be invested in the stock market. So as a percentage of the total, their stock investments and hence their stock losses are relatively minor.
Very interesting, because that was one of the reasons given for the problem in malpractice.
It wasn't the right reason. Some material was given, but it wasn't the right reason.
Some of the materials I got, that was one of the reasons they were having trouble with malpractice. They lost so much money in the stock market. So it's very interesting to find this. There's a 5% limit.
No, we swallow our losses in the stock market. And
okay, that isn't the reason for this difference between 8%
No, now. There are, as I'm sure you know, because there are high interest rates in the marketplace, the bond prices are depressed, and the book value of bonds, in certainly in Occidental's portfolio, and I would suspect in many other companies' portfolio, is the market value is considerably lower than book value on bonds. But again, life insurance, unless, you know, barring any incredibly horrible calamity, life insurance companies have a very significant cash flow coming in. The claims occur, they're well spread out throughout time. There never is a serious drain in cash resources, so they don't ever have to sell bonds to pay off claims or anything else. They can pay out of cash flow. Therefore, the fact that the bond values are depressed is not relevant really to their solvency. Now, you know, if there were an earthquake in Los Angeles, Occidental might have a problem, but so would a lot of other people. It wouldn't bother me. I'd be gone, I think. I think that, well, anyway. The existing regulation, legislation on annuities, which is really the place where the interest change is probably the scariest, is essentially the same. Now, the kind of annuities that are most popular are when people come in at age 65, they're ready to retire, they maybe have cashed in their company's stock plan or something like that, they have a lump of cash, they give it to an insurance company and they say, take this money and pay me as much dollars per month for the rest of my life, $100 a month, $200, however much money they have, okay? The insurance companies take that lump of cash and go buy an 8% bond with it, 20-year bond. And they have guaranteed 8% return on that bond. The current law says that you have to hold a reserve equal to the present value of those future payments, based at 3.5% interest, which is a great deal higher than the cash that is coming the door. If you take a look at chart 3, this is a very simplified illustration, but here's somebody age 65 walking into the insurance company, and all he says is, pay me $1,000 at the end of next year. And we say, okay, we can invest it at 8%. That'll cost you $925.93. The current law says the company has to hold a reserve of $966.18. So the difference is $40.25. Now when you multiply that by... Yes.
I lost one of those corners there. Let me just start that one over again.
All right. I promise you I can take your money and invest it at 8%. Okay, and I'm going to pay you $1,000 at the end of the year. So if you give me $925.93, I'm going to go put it in the savings bank or somewhere at 8% interest, and I will give you $1,000, and I'll come out whole. I'm the insurance company, okay?
Sure.
Now, what the current law says on valuation of annuities is that the insurance company has to set up a reserve equal to the present value of $1,000 at 3.5% interest. So it has to hold, set up a reserve of $966.18. But you only gave me $925.93. So somehow or other, in order for me to sell you that annuity, I have to dig up some money out of my back pocket someplace, which is the insurance company's surplus, to set up enough reserves to be legal with respect to this deal I've made with you. Okay? This has caused a very significant burden to large companies who write a lot of annuities. Because the difference, the discrepancy is so great. Occidental is, in effect, out of the annuity market. We don't even try to be competitive because of this. And the agents call up and they say, hey, you know, I've got a client, he's dying to put this money in, what can you do for me? And I say, sorry, nothing. Because we cannot afford what they call the surplus strain. We want to take our surplus and invest it in other things that will perhaps produce better rate of return. Not in this annuity, okay? So the proposal, which is the 6% interest reserve standard for annuities, is saying, instead of requiring me to set up $966.18 of reserve, it's saying, hey, how about $943.40? That's a 6% interest rate.
What's so magic about 6? I mean, obviously, what's better,
okay,
you have to save less money, but I mean, why aren't you proposing 8 or something else?
Because insurance companies are conservative. I can't promise you that new money rates will be 8% for you know, the next 10 years. I can be fairly confident that they will not drop below 6.
Well, the prime rate is
Rule 6 for a long time. You were actually in competition with the banks in effect, so the prime rate just dropped to about, what, 6.5, 7 the other day, somewhere in the last week or so. But the lowest has been closed.
So your answer is 6% is a conservative guess?
I suppose. I don't know if maybe you're involved in this. I would assume they said if we gone with 8, it would never have flown. And I wouldn't recommend 8. I can't. Remember that it's hard to get laws changed, as I'm sure you know.
We want to do something that will be
conservative for a long time. I don't want to come back next year and say, hey, how about 6.25? Okay? We'll settle for 6.
You started out talking about one of the reasons for the bill being in the interest of uniformity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think last year, Mr. Thomas told us that 34 some number of states had enacted this law, and it was for uniform reporting. Is it then that any figure other than 6% would not be uniform? Is 6% the uniform figure now?
Yes, it is. This bill is the NAIC, that's the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model. If you change the interest rate, okay, well, if let's say you guys were to say, oh, hey, let's go with 8%. Nobody would use the 8%. We would all use the 6, all right? Because it would cost the companies maybe we'd save a little money, but it's not worth the expense purely for one state to change procedures. We'd have to do all our calculations over and so for the Alaska business, okay? However, 6 is the standard in all states that have approved the legislation. Incidentally, I didn't research this very well, but Occidental is interested in passage of this legislation, and I'm not aware of any state where that has not passed the legislation, where it's because of opposition. It's more because of delays, you know, the legislature adjourned without passing it. Illinois is kind of fun. It's become a political hot potato, and it's a daily versus anti-daily thing.
So there's something, Illinois hasn't passed it because of opposition?
Yes, but not to the content.
It's a club.
Pardon? It's a club. Yeah. I think the association's trying to get a sponsor who's not affiliated with either. Anyway. So, the important thing to remember with respect to the annuities is the fact that all that money can be invested the day it is received. The 6 is kind of scary because it is a big increase. But what you have to look at is you say, okay, for how long are interest rates going to stay at a level higher than 6%? And I think it will be for a very long time in the future. Now, another important thing to remember is that a new NAIC regulation, I guess, has been passed by many states, which is requiring the actuaries of the company to certify to the adequacy of the company's liabilities and reserves. There's no way that I would, if new money interest rates were to drop below 6%, 5 or 6 or 10 years down the road, I couldn't sign the annual statement for Occidental. I would, you know, be going counter to my professional training and everything else if I were to sign that knowing that the annuity reserves were inadequate. The NAIC has put the monkey for adequacy of the company's liabilities on the backs of the people who work there. And this is the first year that we're going to have to do this. And although, in effect, actuaries had to do it in the past, but this time I have to I'm going to have to sign and say, I swear, these reserves are adequate. And so, if the interest rates drop down, I'd have to set up some more reserves. Because if I couldn't invest your money at least 6%, then the 6% reserve that I was setting up for it would not be adequate. Okay? It's, I'm sorry it's getting so complicated. I probably lost you completely, I'm sorry.
How about if we just have a diversionary tactic here? You know, when you started out referring to chart 7 and 8, I want to go back for just a second. It's something that's a little bit confusing. They seem to be, you seem to be comparing two charts that are somewhat similar, but actually they're quite a bit different, I guess.
Okay.
And you had a 7 and 8. I just didn't, you know, again, it's kind of a, I think I understand this part, except on chart 7, you don't show any percentage of changes, and I figured out a couple percentages.
So it's more than the same premium drop.
Right, it's a 5.2.
I didn't deliberately do that. You know, let me tell you what happened. Last week, we were, as I mentioned, it was year end at Occidental, and I didn't really have very much time to prepare for this, as it's obvious. But anyway, so I threw these together on Tuesday night. It was getting very, very late. And chart 7 I did at home, chart 8 I did at the office where I had a calculator, was why. But anyway, remember, the point is, the premium difference is every year, okay? The cash value percentage difference, if you were calculating.
Okay, I guess I was probably misled when you noted that the differences on chart 7 were insignificant, as opposed to the substantial changes on chart 8. And again, as I figured out, chart 8, there's a 2% change in the...
I didn't do that on purpose, I'm sorry. That,
I didn't think you were doing it on purpose. I thought I probably missed something.
What are the percentages?
Well, I just figured one of them out, the 652 on the 20th year at age 45.
Mm-hmm.
That difference is about a little over between 5 and 6%. And on the for age 45, on the percent of premium change, issue age 45, we show a 2% difference in the premium.
Okay,
premium.
Now just to do this on a simple basis. You're going to pay the 2% lower premium for 20 years to realize the 5% difference in cash value.
Okay. Or?
Or the dollar something difference.
I didn't figure the other percentage is part of, for instance, after 5 years.
It's a choice that a policyholder has to make. These two illustrations were designed to produce the same profit to the company.
Okay.
That's, and this is the way it turned out mathematically.
Okay.
If you wanted to buy a life insurance policy with a low premium and a low cash value, then the 4% would allow you to do it. However, we have in our portfolio, perhaps, a policy with a higher premium and a higher cash value. And I'll let you buy that too if you like. I'm not an agent. And I don't even get paid for selling them.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
But you've got 9.5% less cash value on your 5-year 4%.
All right.
You've got 7% less premium. Correct?
Okay.
Well, you know, the company's making more money this way. I mean, I'm paying you $7 less out of your 100, right? I'm getting 9 less out of your 100, 9.5 less out of your 100. Now, that 7 is paid over years, but obviously when the company takes this money and invests it, makes profit on it. So it's quite obvious that the companies you make more money under is 4% of the bill under the
bill. No.
Part of your figures here. So, hold on. Right, And I pay you, instead of paying you $100 in premiums, I pay you $93, right? You pay
I'm
me
sorry,
back,
I'm
you pay me back my cash value, you pay me 91 instead of 100.
Which one are you?
Which, yeah, I'm
7 and 8, first item, the five-year cash value. And on the top, the issue age 25 and 7% plus premium on the next page. As I'm looking something backward here.
Okay, I'm telling me that you can either pay me $12.91 for 5 years.
No, we're talking over to the chain. You said a while ago the company, we just figured this out. The company doesn't lose any profit by doing this, right? I'm saying there's any company that makes more money this way, really.
No.
Well, according to your figures, you would like to say.
Well,
I'm paying you.
What's more to me?
Okay, look at number 8, the first line across, okay? Every $100 of premium, if they change this thing from 3.5 to 4, correct? Right? We've got 7% less money, right? So every $100 of premium, I'm going to pay $93 instead of 100, is that correct?
Okay,
right.
Okay.
Okay. Now go back to 7, the first line. They don't have a percentage difference here, but it comes out about 9.5. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when a company pays me my cash value of my policy instead of paying me $100, they pay me $90.50.
All right.
The company
yes.
is obviously making more money on this 24% deal according to these figures.
Wait a minute. Okay. Okay. I at that particular point, if you chose to quit, you would be right. But if you chose not to quit and continued on, you would then be paying $93 out of every 100 for a longer period of time.
Well, it's like your bottom line, you show a 2% drop on the 45 issue, right?
Yeah, okay.
You say all the things you've got here, and then you look at the bottom line of the 20-year paid up thing, figure percentage there. I know that you don't match exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, I think you'll find the percentage there about 5%.
The 652 to the 618.
Mm-hmm. $34, and you buy a 652 at a 34, and you get about 5% somewhere like that. Mm-hmm.
Or you divide 652 and 618 and subtract from 100.
Well, all right, but wait a minute now.
What I'm simply making is that according to the figures here, the three examples you picked out, in each case the company makes more money.
No, really, it is. I wouldn't. If I were trying to do to pull a what? Yes.
Terry, can I just?
I wouldn't have produced such lousy examples if I were trying to show that for him.
I'm not sure I understand it completely, but I think I see what Charlie's point is, and let me try, and if I go wrong, just stop me.
Okay.
So I won't make mistakes. But let's take go to chart 8 and assume that your issue age is 25, and you're going to have that policy for 20 years. At 3.5%, you're paying $12.91 a year
mm-hmm.
premium, which on 20 years would be, I just figured it out here somewhere. Well, I've made mistakes. $398.20, something on that order. I've made a mistake in my calculation.
It's $258.
What's 20 times 1991?
I'm
taking $12.91. That's your premium per year, right? Times 20 years.
$258.
Where else more than that?
$258.10.
No, it's
388.
I'm sorry, Terry. I had it all worked out and I made a mistake. $358.20. Okay, then you go to 4% and take it 20 years, and 20 times 1205 is, I made a mistake on that one, too. 241, okay? 241. So the total amount of premiums that you're paying is, in that case, $117 less.
No,
$17 less. Because the other one is
$17 less.
You guys figured
right.
that
out. $17 less. Okay, then you go to the cash value, and you only receive the cash value once, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of 20 years, you go to the cash value. I think he's right. I made a mistake in my calculations.
Well,
I had it going the other way.
You get $34 less when you cash in, right?
That's right. You get $34 less when you cash in. So
you only pay $17.
Wait a minute, $259 minus $236.
Is
$23.
$23, and the difference in premium is only $17, unless someone's made a mistake in calculation.
All right, but you've got, remember, this is on a 3,000 basis. What you've forgotten is that the compound interest works for you as well. You can take the difference in the savings and go put it in the bank. That's where the difference is.
Well, I was like, the only point I was trying to make was you said about
you're saying that
the company would do about kind of the same either way, right?
Well, no, that was the way. These are real numbers.
I'm not quoting the company making more money. I'm simply saying it is a fact that the company makes more money this way.
No, I disagree. I'm because the way these figures were derived, specifically, it was not.
Explain how 17 minus 23.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
$236 and $259, Charlie, because your issue age is still 25.
Oh, okay. 34.
Okay. Sorry. So you're saying what you said, the difference between the 23 and the 17 is that I could take the 17 for 20 years and invest it. And that's where I say.
Yes, and you might not quit at the end of 20 years, and you have the right to quit at any time. And all these things, remember, life insurance is a business of averages. And if you quit at the 20th year, you never know till you die or till you quit whether your life insurance was a good deal or not.
That's reassuring as a little earthquake in Los Angeles.
That's why I won't be a
chance. I really blowing this thing. Start again. What I was trying to illustrate here only by these charts, those premium rates, which we, the 4% ones are ones we will be charging, okay? The 3%, I had somebody grind off on the computer with the specific objective of producing the same profit to the company for $1,000 of insurance as we had achieved or aimed for on the 4% ones, okay? Now, what the point I was trying to make was the fact that if the company chooses to develop a policy with 4% cash values, the cash values will be lower, but the premium will also be lower to the policy owner. That was all. Okay. I could take a policy that you could say I am paying, you know, if you buy a life insurance policy today, take this 4% illustration, for example. If you multiply the 12.05 at age 25, I haven't done this, but if you live to 100, it would probably amount to more than $1,000, which is more than you're going to get if you die. You can say that's a bad deal. Probably is. But if you die tomorrow, it's a good deal. And that's the way life insurance works. It's very complicated. Anyway, the companies aren't asking for this change in order to make more money. They are asking for it, as I indicated before, to have the facility to have policies with lower cash values than currently are available so that they lose less money on the people who quit early. As I said to Dick before lunch, if you go out and buy a car and you don't like it, you can't turn it back and get all your money back, right? You've made a bad decision, you have to pay for it. And the same thing I think should be true in life insurance by analogy. And if somebody buys a policy and quits after a week, it does cost the company an awful lot of money to refund a higher cash value. So we would like to say maybe on some of these early lapses to have it be a little bit less and keep the price down for the people who don't quit.
Okay, one thing, you're talking about early lapses, and you said, well, it's the 1 and 2 years, this is where you really have the high lapse rate, and this is where it costs you the same amount to set it up. I think that's what you said, whether you drop out 1 year, two year, or 20 year.
Right.
Okay, and so you said the intent was to have less cash value at these lower times, but 20 years is a long time. So you're giving a lower cash value on out to the road.
Wait a minute now. The main purpose of the bill, let's get back there, is really for the annuities, okay? And this thing I explained before about the money having to come out of the surplus of the company. Incidentally, on life insurance, the same problem exists relative to interest. Now, life insurance money comes in on a year-by-year basis. So we can't ever suggest a 6% interest rate on life insurance because I can't promise that I can invest a premium I'm going to receive 20 years from now at 6% interest anyway. But I can't promise you that I can take that premium that I get and invest it at 4% for 20 years. With reasonable confidence, okay? We're setting up minimum standards for these reserves. And the incidental benefit of the change is the fact that as a result of the change, the portfolio of the company may be extended to a plan with lower cash values than is currently possible. Doesn't mean it will be necessarily. I am convinced that not every company in the country is immediately going to change all its plans to have absolutely no cash values or minimum cash values. Because there's a market for people who want high cash values. But if you decide that you want to have a little bit of savings, okay, the minimum savings plan obviously is term insurance that doesn't have any cash values at all. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is where you have a plan that maybe has its values calculated on 2.5% interest. Then you get very high cash values. Well, you're doing a lot of savings.
Mr. Park, if I understand correctly, Mr. Bill, the state director of insurance has the right to approve, the authority to approve the actuarial table that you use in calculating loss rates and stuff. And I assume that you didn't make part of this, I understand, but also using actuarial tables that are more current than the ones that we used initially.
In the annuity thing, yes.
Only in the annuity, not in life insurance. I mean, isn't there longer life expectancy than there was earlier? I noticed something about
that's the reason that the annuity table.
1971 mortality table opposed to 1950.
Yeah, look at chart 2, if you look. This shows the changes on the. That's right, which is a more conservative annuity table. It is assuming, for the purpose of annuities, annuitants tend to live, people who have given $65,000 to an insurance company are only going to do that if they're pretty sure they're going to not die tomorrow. Evidence has indicated that annuitants live longer than other people.
Because they give money to the insurance companies, they're worried about it.
They don't know they're breaking and killed and trying to sue it. There is a difference between the annuity table and the mortality table.
Yes.
Then, if that's correct, are we still using a contemporary life insurance practice to
cables set up in 1937 and 1949 and 1958. For example, on page 2 of the bill, it refers to the 1937 standard annuity mortality table. Now, I don't know what an annuity mortality table is. It's differentiated from annuity table or mortality table. Apparently, it includes both. I don't know. Now, it seems strange to me that there's no operating a table to make 34 years ago, 1937.
That's the reason that the change is being requested in the annuity table. Older people now, because of advances in medicine, are living longer. The 1949 annuity table assumed that, I don't know what the numbers are, but that older people died faster, because they did. It was based on data, you know, collected during the 1930s maybe, when, you know, I don't know what the life expectancy was, but maybe 60 years. For annuities, now the company has to set up enough money for the, this isn't quite actuarially right, but for the life expectancy of somebody age 65, which is now longer than it used to be, okay?
Well, now my point, my question was initially, I believe the commissioner has the authority to approve the tables that are being used. Is that, do I understand correctly?
Well, there's some question whether the degree of his approval authority when the law is changed, or even as the law is now, how much he can vitiate for that law. I think he can use modifications of the 37 or 49 or 58 table, but I don't think he can change the different tables.
No, I don't mean change the table, but he can say this table is this, so it's okay to use this particular table.
No, I don't think he can. I think that as the law presently reads, he's obligated to use this table.
How long have you been in this bill?
Well, under the present law and this bill.
Remember, this is the amendment. The change in the mortality table, however, is a change in the interest of conservatism from this 49 annuity table to the 71 annuity table, which now says these people who buy annuities are going to live longer than that old standard table used to assume. Okay, so it will, that will force the reserves to be greater because
of either of these tables. But I don't think you can change
the annuitants will live longer.
Change that up here. Terminology, go to say the 1971 tables.
Well, Mr. Chairman, over this very complex changing of whatever we've been talking about, how's the consumer come out better? Is he better over the, you know, by having a 39 years opposed to 71?
39, 71.
You mean on the annuity
tables
by having?
Okay.
Yeah, it would seem that the very costs, you know, costs and benefits were figured into a 1937 table, which said that he was going to expire earlier than he actually does. You know, than he actually is going to by 1971. That he might be getting a break by the use of the 1937 annuity table at this time to your detriment, but to his benefit. Is there any validity in my cloudy reasoning?
Remember that this bill is concerned with the solvency of the companies, okay? Certainly, to the degree that we are in this particular change, strengthening the solvency of the companies by saying people with annuities are living longer, so you better hold more money so that the companies won't go broke and the annuitants won't get their money, there is a consumer benefit, okay? In terms of price, okay, two justifications. The thing about the availability of lower premiums on life insurance that I talked about before, and also the fact that because of the low interest rate right now, the companies are not aggressively selling annuities, so their availability is limited, would be also a consumer advantage. There's very little actual prices in life insurance are not regulated today, other than by competition. The competition is fierce.
What happens when you get the new annuity tables, you
said that that causes more reserve. Yep, this is what it's directed at, is creating more reserves. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. How do you get more reserves?
All right, can I do it very simply? Pretend you're 65 and your life, and the life expectancy today of a 65-year-old is 15 years. I can't do that calculation. 20 years. All right? And I'm going to pay you $100 a year for 20 years. All right? Essentially, the life expectancy, let's say, according to the 71 annuity table, is 20 years. So I'd have to set up a reserve the moment you come walking in, ignoring interest, of 20 times 100 or $2,000, all right? Now, the old annuity table, maybe somebody age 65 said the life expectancy is only 15 years, okay? So I would only have had to set up a reserve based on that table of $100 times 15, or $1,500, okay?
Where's the new $500
come from? The fact that people are living longer now, and the 71 annuity table.
Yeah, but you reserve $1,500 over here so you can pay that, right? Okay, now you're going to reserve $2,000. So there's a difference of $500 in the amount of reserves. Where's that $500 come from?
Wait a minute. Old annuity. All of this relates only to new business or any new policies. We're not going to go take.
No, okay.
All right.
I don't understand your question.
But you are going to have to charge more money, aren't you, to cover that additional $500 of life, additional 5 years of life expectancy?
More premium dollars.
More.
Right.
Right.
No, because the rates themselves for annuities are based on realistic, the company's best guess as to what their experience will be. The premium rates for annuities are not based on 71 annuity table. That is a conservative table.
Well, she's
so.
You buy the annuity with a cash lump sum type thing, you know, at the beginning. So you, when the customer comes in and buys an annuity, it's going to cost you $2,000, but you're promising to pay $2,000 on it. He pays you more than if you buy an annuity on which you're paying $1,500. Mm-hmm. The customer pays that $500, and most of that $500 difference the day he walks in and signs his contract.
No.
Okay, take the same example. And pretend there's no interest rate.
All right.
Okay? And so you got to reserve, under the old plan, you had to reserve $1,500. Under the new plan, you got to reserve $2,000, right?
Okay.
All right. I walk in. How much do I have to give you under both plan X and Y?
All right. Let's say we change the law at noon today, okay? And yes. So at 11:55 this morning, you came and bought one, gave me a premium. I would have to set up a reserve of $1,500. At 12:01, you come in and buy one from me. I would have to set up a reserve of $2,000. But you would pay me the same premium at either time, and it could be $1,100. Because remember, I can take your $1,100 and go earn 8% interest on it.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
Terry, which what you're, do I understand, Daphne, that this bill or this law dealing with valuation of life and disability and annuity reserves really has no bearing on the calculations or the tables used by the carriers to arrive at the premium?
Yes, sir.
In other words, this is in order to establish what reserves the company must maintain on a statutory basis and has nothing to do with the prices charged by the company.
That's
the
right.
The price may be based on a February 1976 judgment by the company as to what they think the life expectancy is. That will be the premium charge. The reserve behind that policy will be based on what the statute says they have to establish.
Right.
Okay. So really this bill and this law have nothing to do with the charges or the premiums to the policyholder. It has only to do with establishing what minimum reserves the carrier must establish to support those policies. Is that a fair statement?
Right.
That's the case. You have chart 8 and you already mentioned the word premium for others.
I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, let's pursue that. Look, okay, I could get that, but okay, you're just saying we're establishing statutory minimums. Okay, but still, there's a cost of that, right? If you're going to have more reserves, you're going to have higher premiums.
Well, I think that's the point, Terry. What you're talking about.
There is, to a minor degree, that is true, yes. Because we are, a corporation, I don't know what the current profit objective for a corporation's return on equity is, but let's say it's 15%. That's their profit objective, okay? So if Occidental takes some of its surplus, on which presumably it could go out and earn 15%, and has to go throw it in reserves where it can't do anything with it. There is a cost associated with that, yes.
Technical question.
Yeah.
How are these reserves held? Do you know?
In bonds, mortgages. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, what happens is each year end, we say for each policy, what is the reserve? What is the number of dollars attributable to the reserve for a particular policy? And you add them all up, and you subtract them from your total assets, and what's left is your capital and surplus. Is your capital and surplus, right?
In other words, do they have to be liquid?
No.
So when you make money out of anything, like bonds, mortgages,
Well,
they're investments.
I would suspect that a certain part of them have to have a special amount of liquidity because you may, plus, you probably table those out just like we do with their state investment. Some of them you've got to be able to grab now, and some 5 years, and some in 20.
You didn't bring the annual statement, did you?
No, I didn't bring it.
That's okay. Cash flow.
The answer to your question is exactly that. One of the difficulties, I think, in understanding the investments of an insurance company is assuming they have everything in neat separate buckets. The life reserves are invested here, and the annuity reserves are invested there, and the surplus someplace else. And it's really all a fungible sum of assets, but on the ledger sheet it shows that they owe so much in reserves for this, that, and the other thing. But if I may, Chairman, as I understand the proposed amendments, Daphne, you would have us enact a statute that would impose a more conservative tables for calculating minimum reserves. The 1971 annuity tables are more conservative than the 39, 37, and 49 tables.
Yes.
That's going to have the effect of increasing the reserves. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. You also would suggest that we impose a higher interest rate in that calculation, that is, giving credit for higher rates of interest in the discounting of present value of dollars. That's going to have the effect of reducing reserves. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
What is the net difference between the two, and in which direction is it?
The net, I don't have that. As I recall, it is a slight net decrease.
In reserves?
In reserves. But it bears what I believe to be a more proper relationship. The interest and the mortality blend in together and create complicated patterns. What we've done is the mortality is now closer to current experience, which is better mortality. The interest is also closer to current interest, the 8% we're talking about. And put it all together and you're creating reserves that are more modern and more closer to what conservative, but closer to what realistic patterns might emerge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
technique, with this legislation, this change, do you feel that your company can give more assurance of paying claims on insurance? In other words, does it strengthen the ability of your company over a period to pay off its claims? Or does it simply give your company the opportunity to run a better investment program?
Our company's in business to make money. I don't believe that this change will impair Occidental's ability to pay claims, which has never been impaired, and I doubt it ever will be. So it's not going to make any difference. What it will do is perhaps allow us to take some of the surplus that we have not been reluctant to invest in annuities and start investing it in annuities to get competitive in the annuity market, or at least to become active in the annuity market. And to, or if not that, maybe to go into other ventures and perhaps to make some money in other ventures.
In other words, what you're saying is going to release some capital or other...
Yeah, but that's not why I'm here. It's not to make Occidental make more money. It's just because the law as it currently stands is out of date. It is inhibiting the progress of the life insurance industry to sell a public product, which is an annuity. And I don't believe it's the intent of anybody to inhibit business. I think decent business. And the purpose of the reason I'm here is to get this law modern, like, and also to get the uniform legislation.
I'd like to get one thing from you. If all of this may or may not make sense on just the thing you said about, well, this will be a net decrease in the amount of reserves, or a slight decrease. I'd like to know how much.
I think I do have that in my file. So.
You need a calculator.
Hmm? No, I there was a memo that I received with the association. Just a second.
You know, if there's one subject that this committee can get, at least some members, namely yours truly, that is Billy Brown and its issues.
I think this should have done the toast.
All right.
It did go to the conference.
Yeah, thank you. Usually
here's
explain
the answer.
This stuff.
At 6%, the ratio of reserves on the new basis to the old basis would be 88.5%.
So you'd have.
I'm sorry, it was not the slide.
A 12%
drop.
That's what this affected the bill would be, or just the one section?
That would be the effect of the one section, the change on annuities. If you look at chart two, it would be this, the second box there, the individual single premium immediate annuities.
Okay, that's from the 3.5 to 6 on annuities.
And the change in mortality table.
It includes, okay.
Okay. Now, please remember what I said about the 6%, however, and the fact that, yes, it is a 12% drop in reserve, but the fact that that 12% drop in reserve is still producing a conservative reserve, and the fact that the reserves we're holding right now are inhibiting the sale of annuities.
Mr.
Chair, could I ask you a closer
question?
Are you really?
Could you follow through a little bit on that narrative?
Okay.
Explain
inhibiting
if you can how releasing some of your reserve capital over to your whatever you call the other bundle is going to allow you to get into.
I emphasize we will not be releasing any reserve capital. The reserves on the business we have sold will remain the same level.
Well, not having to create as large a reserve,
all right,
it gives you a better cash
position. Is this illustration again about the fact that on chart three, the illustration of the surplus thing, about the fact that I'm going to get a premium for this $1,000 of $925, and right now I have to hold the reserve of $966, and reflecting only the interest. That's, that $966 is costing me $40 out of my surplus.
When we're talking about new businesses, new annuity,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll
check
it
out.
That's the request.
Okay, what, now what, we got 34 states that this has been passed?
41.
Okay, so now in these other states, you've got this 12% or whatever it happens to be, reserves have now been turned loose.
No, oh, right, yeah, okay.
On the futures.
Yes, I.
All right. So, are you selling more annuities, or you said that you could, this would allow you to become more active in annuities or possibly some other investments?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you more active in those other states? Can you demonstrate that to us?
No, because we spent all our time developing our new life rate book, which is the life insurance piece of this thing, and we have not yet. Done very much in annuities, okay? I think one of our next projects would be to...
What about other companies?
I can't speak for them.
But that's your plan now in these other states, you're like pushing annuities?
No. Now, Occidental's biggest emphasis has always been, and I think would continue to be, life insurance. We do have a lot of pension business, which I had, group annuity business, which essentially is following the same pattern. And that would help us, yeah. That's not my area, so I've forgotten it.
Okay, what you normally do with whatever money you don't have in reserves, you invest and try to make money.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so is that, that's what you mean by your other investments? You take this 12%. Invest in other places, make more money, either keep it at lower prices or whatever you do.
Mm-hmm. We go into foreign countries.
Like Alaska.
No, like Australia.
Well, okay, does anybody else have any questions? Sam?
So therefore, the surplus is invested quite differently than reserves.
No, Occidental somewhere in our building, I don't know where it is, there's a lot of money, okay? There's the assets of the company, right? The assets of any company are invested in a whole bunch of things, and it's all, this is the thing Dick was explaining before. Whatever money we get in, we go buy a bond with, or buy a mortgage with, or build a home office with. The reserves are a calculated number that we are not allowed to do anything with. We can't go spend it.
Can I stop you right there? When you say you're not allowed to do anything with it, at the same time you say you buy mortgages and bonds with it. What do you mean when you say you can't do anything?
Okay. I think most states have minimum capital and surplus requirements for life insurance companies. If our Occidental's surplus got below that minimum, we would be insolvent and we would go into receivership and there would be a horrible scandal and so on and so forth. If our reserves, they can't do this, but.
You know what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to put your surpluses in one bucket and the reserve in another, and I'm trying to see what you're doing with both. And I understand you have to maintain a certain reserve.
The more reserves we have, the less surplus we have, is really what it is, okay?
But
bookkeeping.
It's bookkeeping, is exactly what it is, right.
Okay, but on your chart three there, you show that you're having to use your surplus money to put into your reserve. Okay, well, bookkeeping or not, I'm missing something here. I apologize for it.
Isn't it just that your reserves are certain types of investment that statutes that you can have, like, they would allow, say, government bonds? It's just.
Kind of liquid, right? You couldn't go to the home office building and put $10 million in part of your reserves.
But what if any difference there is, there are restrictions on investments?
Well, you wouldn't call it a surplus either, you'd call it a capital investment.
We have assets, okay, we have a bunch of investments, mortgages, bonds, so on and so forth. They all have a value, you add them up, those are the assets of the company.
Sure.
Okay. The other side of the balance sheet is liabilities. The total is equal to, the assets is an amount of money we've got, okay? Then our biggest liability is this reserve, which we are required to hold. You just grind it out. You look at each policy, you say this policy has to have a reserve of $25, that policy has to have a reserve of $1,000. We end up with a number, a total for all the business we have, okay? We then subtract that total from the bottom line here, which is the total money we've got altogether. That's our surplus.
All right?
No, that's good.
One other thing, I think you already covered it, but I think I missed this too. You mentioned that 41 states had this law amended as this bill outlines. In order for uniformity to take place, do all 50 states have to pass before you people can act in that manner?
No.
So you're starting to.
We are going to introduce our new rate book in the states that have the 4% March 1st, and we'll introduce it in the other states as the legislation is passed.
So you'll still be able to operate, even if 49 states do it and Alaska never does. Well,
that's right.
All you're going to have to do is just offer a different rate plan to Alaska.
Yes, but that costs us money.
Yeah.
And they won't get our nice policy forms that we've done for our new rate book. It's a big, I'm sure you care, but.
You mean the one with the centennial cover?
No,
we understand.
We call it the pride of authorship. We're following up with our own words that somebody else writes.
Some of us.
I'm afraid I thoroughly confused you. I'm sorry. This really was organized when I started out, and I hope I've helped at least to. If not to thoroughly confuse you, maybe remove some of the clouds. The message I'd like to leave you with, if I may, is this is not a big deal. There are bigger deals in the world. I request your consideration. Thank you.
At some point in time, I wanted you to testify. Are you prepared to do that today, or would you like to do it sometime later?
Well, I'm not prepared to testify today with any degree of sophistication on this because I'm learning about it the same as you. Daphne has alluded to the fact that she has visited with me about it, and indeed she did this morning, but only for about an hour. So I have about a 1 hour head start on the rest of the committee on this, and I would like to study it just a little bit more. If you'd rather I wait to testify, I'll be happy to. But I would, while Daphne is here, I'd like to ask one question, if I may.
Okay. Do we have somebody in the Attorney General's office, the society, you guys in the insurance division, that knows anything about it?
Well, the answer to that is, to the first part is yes, and to the second part, I would suspect no.
Okay. Well, if there is somebody up there that understands something, maybe you could have them come down too.
Okay.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Daphne, my understanding of Section 110 is that it applies to the establishment of reserves for the company on a gross basis. By that I mean the reserves of the company's balance sheet, and not with respect to specific books of business. That is, not with respect to its business in Alaska or its businesses in Kansas or in any other state. It deals with the establishment of its company reserves as shown on its total balance sheet. Is that correct?
Almost Entirely, yes. Except that I think each company tends to be controlled by its state of domicile.
The state of domicile for Occidental, for example, is California.
Yes, in other words,
California's adopted the law as you would have it amended here.
However, we would not be able to value our Alaska business on 4% because you wouldn't permit it.
When you file your annual statement, do you have a separate valuation with respect to your Alaska business reflected in your annual statement?
No.
Doesn't Section 110 actually mean, from the standpoint of evaluating reserves in order to determine solvency, that all of your business in any state written has to be valued? Do not I, as the director of insurance, in deciding whether or not you ought to be admitted to do business in the state, have to look at all your annuity business and all of your endowment business and apply the standards in Section 110 to determine what your surplus is, whether it's Alaska or California business?
I think if every director of insurance or equivalent did that, he would have a dreadful problem.
Well, that's not the point. The point is, isn't that what the law says I have to do? It says in evaluating reserves, unfortunately this amendment doesn't have the whole law, but I believe it says that in evaluating the assets and liabilities of the company, this is how I value the reserves.
It doesn't say company? Where does it say that?
Well, in part not in the amendment, but in the law.
Well, I think the scope of your authority only extends to Alaska business.
Yeah, but what he's saying is you couldn't operate in Alaska if you didn't comply with this, and we're just analyzing it on a company basis, not on your state business.
That's right.
So he'd be forced to not allow you to operate in Alaska if your reserves didn't comply with this.
That's possible, yes.
Okay, but isn't it also a fact, Daphne, that the report
that you're submitting... I think we would complain a lot.
Well, isn't it a fact, though, that your company, as all other major life companies that are in this line of business, are not reporting in accordance with Section 110, but rather are reporting in accordance with the law in their state of domicile? For example, the New York companies, and New York has this law, California companies, are setting their reserves in their sheet, in their balance sheet, in their convention statement that comes to the regulators, in accordance with the proposed amended law.
Yes, you are right. Except I should say we are not right now selling any 4% business anyplace. It won't be until March 1st. There are certain states that require stricter reserves and certain little small technical pieces of things. Texas is an example. And in such circumstances, Texas requires stronger reserves than California does, according to regulation, not legislation. We would then set up those extra reserves for our Texas business only. Okay.
Well,
there is a very big problem
is,
here.
I understand that, but the fact of it is that no matter what our law says, unless it creates a major distortion in dollars for your company, you're going to report it as California requires you to report it. And you're going to report it that way to all commissioners. And it's up to us to either agree or disagree with it, is it not?
I just want to be sure that I understand what you're saying. We will report the business we sell. We intend to sell some business which will involve the 4% minimum valuation standard
right. In
states other than Alaska.
Right.
That business, yes, we will value at 4% interest.
Mm-hmm.
We will not report we will not be selling any of that business in Alaska, and so whatever business we do sell in Alaska will still be at 3.5 or higher. And that will be reported at 3.5.
Suppose California, which is your state of domicile, had not amended the law, but Alaska did. So we have a 4% standard and California has a 3.5. And suppose that you did sell some 4% business in Alaska, would you not be obligated to reflect your reserves on a 3.5% basis as required by your state of domicile?
I believe so, yes.
So that isn't it really a true statement, Daphne, that what you sell in the state of Alaska, whether you sell annuities or not, isn't really dependent upon whether we enact a law amending your basis evaluation of your reserves. It's going to be based on whether you can make a profit on it.
Say that again.
Whether you sell business in the state of Alaska, whether you provide an annuity program, and at what rates you would provide it, has no bearing, is not going to be affected by whether or not this law has changed. It's going to be affected only by whether or not you perceive profitability from that business.
That is right, yes. Except, we want to do business in Alaska. And I think what will happen if the law is not passed is that Alaska will be forgotten, as is happening in health insurance. And many, many states are passing diverse regulations. Each state has its own idea about what particular extra benefit it would like to have incorporated, a kidney transplant benefit and a newborn children benefit, which happens to be one that's fairly common. Whenever we run into a state now on hospital insurance that has a new requirement, rather than comply, we are withdrawing from business in those states because it's not cost justified to comply. And I'm not sure that's very good for the public or for the industry.
Are you suggesting then that if we didn't pass the bill, that you'd leave Alaska?
No, not at all. What I am suggesting is that, let's say this thing runs along 4 or 5 years, and Alaska were the only state that was a holdout, and we would be grinding them up. Pretty soon our agents in Alaska would be maybe getting a little bit depressed. Meanwhile, the agents from Washington might be popping in and say, hey, the business might not be being placed in Alaska, which possibly has. I don't mean to create a great dramatic situation here. But Alaska might not have available the most modern products, which we would be making available in other states, because we would not ever do a special product just for Alaska, because it would not be cost justified. Nor would we for any other state, by the way.
What's the optimum age group purchasing insurance? Is it 30 or 40 or, you know, when does the greatest age group go out and grab insurance?
20s and early 30s.
Well,
it's almost too late for you, Bob.
Let the record show I'm worth $100,000. For $238.50. We got just tens of thousands coming up in the next 20 years of that age group. I can't imagine why anybody'd try to,
a lot of breeding.
Try to what?
I don't see why anybody'd want to leave the state for half a percentage point when.
No, the point is not that we would leave. I don't at all want to.
Well, I mean, you know, not after that.
We are right now. We have this whole new rate book that's designed involving the 4% on in only a few plans, not all plans, or anything else. But we have one really neat new plan that involves the 4%. I think it's very exciting. I feel a good one. I'm not selling it to you.
It's like super.
Can you imagine this girl finding a life insurance policy exciting? I get a dollar.
Okay, that plan, there's no way. That plan involves the reserves, and the cash values are based on the 4% interest, okay? It's an interesting idea, and there's no way we would go and do all the work involved in developing that involving 3.5% interest. So that concept of a plan will not be available in those states from Occidental.
Yeah, but Daphne, what I don't understand, there's nothing in this bill that I see, in the current law that I see, that prohibits you from selling that plan in Alaska at 4%.
because
my conscience would prohibit me from allowing it to be done, because I don't believe that it is the intention today of the law to to allow it to be so.
How do you get that? It says you have to have 3.5% reserves.
The company does have to.
What's that?
If it says 3.5, how can you have 4?
Because what I'm saying, Terry, is that the company is obligated to maintain its gross reserves in accordance with this law. But that doesn't speak to the issue as to how much premium they charge. In other words, if they felt that there was a heavy market here, suppose our state was 5 times the size that it is, and the market was 5 times larger, and they wanted to come in here, there's nothing would prohibit them from selling it. And we do not regulate the rates of insurance, so they could sell it at any rate they wanted, design a contract that provided any cash.
Cash values is the problem.
Our cash values may be the problem, but the product could be offered nonetheless. It may affect their overall reserves, but not really, because they're keeping them in accordance with California law. They're not keeping them in accordance with Alaska law, even though they're selling Alaska products. And that's true right now.
It just happens now that their gross reserves happen to comply with the law.
Yes.
Their gross reserves equal or are stronger than what our law requires.
Okay.
That's right.
I cannot design a product and have it sold in Alaska, however, that one which has cash values that are below the 3%, the 3.5% minimum cash values as here defined. Okay.
But doesn't go either to product design. That goes to the amount of reserves you have to establish for your non-forfeiture provision.
Wait a minute. There's a relationship, yes. If I designed a product with lower cash values than these minimums and came waltzing in here, and sold one, I think I would be in violation of the law as it now stands. If I had one that happened to be based on 3.5% or something, cash values that happened to be based on a 4% formula but turned out being higher than the minimums here, I'm okay. I could sell that one. Mm-hmm. But I think that the way Occidental interprets the various state statutes, we would feel that business would have to be valued at 3.5% reserves. It's getting complicated again.
Okay, are you going up to Anchorage?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm sure you're going to run across Mr. Fink up there.
Who is that?
Tom Fink.
He's in Las Vegas.
No, he's going to be back in Anchorage. But I got a letter from Mr. Fink's a former member of the legislature and of this committee.
And
he's also he's also the head of the legislative committee for the Alaska Life Underwriters. And he says the Alaska Life Underwriters and I are strongly opposed to the above-numbered bill. The insurance companies are promoting the bill. We have listened to the pitch of the companies and have determined that we are very much opposed to the bill. So they know you're coming, so I hope you get together with them, because Mr. Fink, I'd ask him to come down here and testify on the bill after he had talked to you. So I would hope you could connect up with him, so otherwise he's not going to know what you really said here, and I'm not sure I can relate it. Mr. Fink,
what's the basis of them being opposed to you?
I wish I knew. I am absolutely unable to.
No, he just sent me a short letter saying that he wanted to testify and that they were opposed not to do anything.
I talked to him about it one time. He wanted to, same sort of insurance jargon that you did.
I tried very hard in preparing for
one thing that he did
testimony.
Say was that the insurance companies really weren't able to predict what the interest rates would be in the future, and since they were lower in the past, now they seem to be higher as far as interest rates on the open market, but the insurance companies they're guessing as to what they may be in the future. And that's the only thing I remember, but I don't know if that's valid at all.
It seems on the basis of experience, though, that the statutory rates are bad guesses. I mean, that's sort of the point.
Yeah, but you can come back and
see how easy it is.
Where was my little chart? I had a little chart in here on interest rates, chart 4. Kind of showed the trend in insurance interest rates over the years, okay?
It shows about 30 years when it was below 4.
Yes, but I think, remember again the professional certification and the fact that an actuary in a company has a responsibility to hold adequate reserves. Let's say that interest rates 10 years from now went down to 3.5%. And we're sitting here selling business 4% interest. I would consider it my professional responsibility to have that company hold higher reserves.
Daphne, can I interject something else? As I understand it anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, of course. The chart you have here is of the average return and not the new money return, isn't that right?
That's right.
Okay, so if you're talking about new money return, you're talking about an annuity contract, then until the current interest rate goes below, you don't have a real problem. When your average return goes below the rate that you've set, then you've got a problem with your life insurance policies. Because that's something where you're getting the money over a long period of time and investing it and having to come out ahead.
When we use realistic interest assumptions in pricing our life insurance products, and our current interest table starts at 8% level for like 3 years and grades down, and we don't hit 4% for 20 years. I think it's more than that. And that's a conservative table.
In the life insurance industry, do you have any feeling for how much reserves would be released or have been released by virtue of this change in dollars?
Well, I only know of one company that has a rate book out using the 4%. So it's not really, I can't answer it because it hasn't happened yet.
That's in relation to that 12% figure you earlier gave.
That's right. 12, that's annuities. I'm sorry, I was talking about life insurance. There was some test, something in one of these other rooms. Here's a statement that was prepared by the Life Insurance Association on the annuity question. Some large life insurance company currently charges a male age 65 $10,056 to buy a single premium annuity of $100 a month. The reserve it must set up under the current law is $12,540. So it's getting in the door 10,000 even, essentially. It has to set up 12,005. The company suffered a surplus drain of $24,800,000 in 73 on their entire block of business. That's the, like the $42 in that chart we were talking about before, the amount that they had to pull out of surplus over and above the premium to set up the reserve. That's one company. So it's causing a problem. Does that answer the question?
We'd be interested in any information like that. I'll
try to develop some more.
Okay. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
She had a great smile. You must admit that this is exciting. I think the only people that find insurance exciting are their wives.